All right, 27. Where are we? 27. Does your Proverbs go to 37? I want those extra ones. It's like a Catholic Bible. Sweet. 27:10. Proverbs. Indeed. Do not forsake your own friend or your father's friend, and do not go to your brother's house in the day of calamity. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother far away. What is this admonishing us to do or not to do? Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother far away. What would you guess would be the condition of the individual that is being spoken of? Why is he trying to go to his neighbor's house or his brother's house? What's going on in his life? Something's wrong, right? So he needs what? People. He needs safety. Probably not just safety, but in calamity, like when his life is upside down in his day of calamity, what is he looking for? Help from who? People, right? What is our tendency, by the way, when life gets upside down? What do most people tend to do?
Retreat.
Isolate, right? Retreat and to hide, right? 18:1, I think, says as much. And it's a warning sign for those that... he who separates himself seeks his own desire and quarrels against all sound wisdom. There's something to be said for those that when life just kind of hits the fan and does what it does, and we're in the midst of difficulty, to be looking for others. This text, by the way, in 27:10, is not condemning family. It's saying it's better to have someone in the midst of life that you can go to, that is a close friend, than to not have that option. Okay, so make sure, just as a life point, as you think through your circle of friends, number one, turn real quick to 18:24. This is a good nugget. Yeah, read 18:24.
A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother.
So as you think through your friends, first of all, what is that text admonishing us to do? Yeah, I probably would use different language, but yes, I think that's about right. So a BFF, or at least an inner circle of people. So having a gazillion friends isn't necessarily helpful if you've got a zillion companions. You need a few select folks in your life that you know, man, when it is bad, I have people to go to. Man, that can be family, that can be friends, that can be mentors, but we need that in our life. And there's times when that's going to be given and that's going to be received. And as you think about that handful of friends that you have, do you have that in your life? Do you have people that you're going to go to? Those are the folks that are going to stand with you at your wedding. They're the folks that are going to admonish you, you know, through job crises and life and when you need advice on big, like, fork-in-the-road decisions. They're going to be people that will tell you that, look, I'm not impressed with you, and you're in sin, and you need to go apologize. And I love you enough to tell you that you're an idiot, right? I've got very few friends that will do that for me. And the ones that I have like that, we have long history together, and I'm very, very grateful. And there is a few that I can think of that we have been through mountaintops and valleys. We have said difficult things to one another that needed to be heard. We've apologized, we've repented, we've done it all. But I'm very, very grateful that God has given me people in my life to help shape me, because I have blind spots, right, in my life, as you probably do in yours. Yours are probably smaller than mine, but I have them. And I need folks in my life. And when it is difficult, I need people to go to, because I have a tendency, probably like you, to isolate myself and to not want to share and to not want to, because it's just easier, right? But it's not helpful. So Proverbs admonishes us in numerous places to not flee to isolation, but to run to others in the midst of calamity. Okay, so just as a good reminder for life, you will need that forever. And if you don't, boy, it's a lonely place being depressed and having no one around, right? That is not a fun place to be. So I was just talking to a buddy of mine last night at Halloween whose first kid was just like a terror, right? Just most difficult child, just in terms of, like, never stopped crying. And the mom was just like, ah. And there was something about having other moms around that had a kid that was the same way. They were like, oh yeah, my kid was that way too. They didn't fix the problem. They just went, oh yeah, I've been there and that stinks. And he ultimately is going to grow out of that and it's going to get better. You're like, oh, thank God. Like, okay, there's a season, this will end, and here's some thoughts and advice. And there's just something about the comfort of other people being around to speak into our worlds that can be much needed in these types of days. All right? Thoughts? All right. Genesis, we shall go. To Joseph, shall we? 37, we just picked up at the beginning of Joseph's story. Let's see how far we can get into this today. By the by, Ben and Sonny could not make it this morning. They had an issue come up last night and just said, hey, we're going to have to reschedule. So we will bring them in another time, so you will get to meet them, but it will not be this morning. So don't cry. You get me for 1 hour and 30 minutes, every bit of it. So sorry. Melanie, will you pray for us, and then we'll dive in, now that I'm with your mouth full of food, so, or Dave, you're one flesh, you can pray as well, so, either way, you're still married, we fixed that yesterday before we left, so, we're good. Amen. All right. Well, as we talked about a little bit yesterday, this is probably one of my favorite chunks of Scripture. It's just so rich. The story is so powerful. Again, one of the neatest pictures of redemption in our Bible. You guys know the story, but it's really powerful to see the life of this young man, Joseph, and then his plight and what happens, and just the degree to which God just, man, turns the screws in his life. It's difficult, but yet he is a very gracious and forgiving guy. Let's enjoy it together, right? So yesterday we found out Jacob is in the Shephelah. They are still shepherds living in that area, Hebron and the like. Joseph is 17 years old when he comes on the scene. He's got a little brother, Benjamin. He's the youngest of the family aside from Ben, but he is in the house still. Joseph is outside. And what do we learn about Joseph's role within the family? Yeah, so Jacob saw something in him, put him as a steward. Rachel asked a great question yesterday. In verse 2, we see the fact that it says Joseph was out with his with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. I think the idea may be, based on what I was kind of reading, it says he was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah. It may have been that all of his brothers were there, more than likely, and he was potentially put over just those. Or maybe that he was asked to oversee the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah specifically, as opposed to Leah's kids and Rachel, who Rachel only has he and Benjamin. So regardless, what you're going to see is an initial problem with those sons, and then it's going to ramp up to the entire group of sons, and then it's even going to go to dad, where Joseph quickly isolates himself in the midst of the family. Not intentionally, but he's going to be in a spot where everyone, mom included, is against him, which is a bad spot to be. Okay, so he brings back in verse 2, we heard about it yesterday, a bad report. So his brothers are doing something that they shouldn't be doing, potentially, we don't know which ones, but something in regards that they shouldn't have been doing. Joseph, or Jacob, this whole time in verse 3, has been showing favoritism, right? And the kids have seen that. He's now 17 years old. He's been born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He's the spoiled child, according to his brothers. And verse 4, as a result, they saw this as well, which is even more painful, obvious, but they see it. And their hatred, it says for him in verse 4, grew, and they could not speak to him on friendly terms. I mean, that's a pretty significant divide caused by a father, right? So with the best of intentions, I'm sure Joseph or Jacob probably didn't intend to divide his family, but he did it, okay? So, and he was blatant about it, right? When you make your kid a robe and say that, you know, you are the champion and give him a trophy, I guess that's what happens, so, okay? Now, we're going to see that there's something unique about this kid. Pick up in verse 5, and let's see what continues to be true in the lives of the patriarchs.
Now, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more.
All right, so he's got a dream. Why is that significant?
Because of how God.
Yeah. Keep going. How has God spoken to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob? Every one of them has heard from God in a dream, right? Different things, whether it was at Bethel or God put Abraham to sleep and he passed through the parts, but they have heard God's voice through dreams, okay? So Joseph is now another kid that has been spoken to via God, and you know, he shares this dream, which we're going to find out why. They hate him. Verse 6, he says, hey, listen. So, you know, they're all at the dinner table, and he says, hey, listen to me. Behold, verse 7, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. Right? Pretty clear. Mine was the boss. You were all the peons. All of you bowed down to me. You know, it's like, not real difficult to figure out what this means, okay? His brothers say, are you really, in verse 8, going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us? So this, again, continues the animosity. So Joseph is just, man, he just doesn't know what he doesn't know. So he doesn't realize how his brothers feel about him. And again, that's not all his fault. He was the favored kid, and that's a little bit on, that's a whole lot on Jacob. But he worsens the situation by just not maybe having a clear picture of what would have been the best course of action. So in verse 9, he has another dream, and he says it's the same dream, just a different interpretation. And he tells his brothers again. Okay, this time it's about stars and moons. Let's see, verse 9, behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. Like, dang, right? So who are the sun and the moon in this context? Mom and dad, and the 11 stars are all my brothers. Like, yeah, I'm the chief star, right? I am the center of the known universe, right? So you can see, like, this is the only part of Joseph's life where you look at it and go, probably not the best decision. I wouldn't call it sin. God revealed this to him. He's simply saying, this is what happened. But maybe at 17, he didn't quite have the tact and the discernment to know how to communicate that or when to not communicate something. And he's a 17-year-old male, so that would not be far from reality, right? I don't know. You see a ton of godliness in this kid, and you see godliness immediately in difficulty. So what do you do with that? What's the other option? I mean, do you sit on it? Do you, you know, I don't know. So potentially, but I think it's one of those things where it was just a multitude of factors that all stacked together created a bad situation, and he unfortunately just had his own gasoline to throw in the fire. So, but yeah, there's probably some pride involved. Okay? So, his brothers, verse 11, were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. What does that mean? Jacob kept the saying in mind. What does Jacob realize?
He's special.
Why?
Because God's speaking.
Yeah, so he realizes, man, I'm not a big fan of that. However, if God's revealing something to you in a dream, I need to make mind of that or be mindful of that. Now, this isn't revealed to Joseph at this point, but his dad is, he's tucked it away. He's like, huh, okay, so I need to think through that, right? His brothers went to pasture their father's flock at Shechem, okay, so what's the last time we've seen Shechem in our story? What happened there? Slaughter, right? Levi, Simeon, bunch of men were supposed to get circumcised, which they did. It just ended very badly. So the side effect of circumcision apparently is death, so that's what they got, okay? So they're in Shechem. And Joseph now, or Israel, you see he's identified in the, or Jacob rather, is identified in the text as both. He says, are your brothers, in verse 13, not pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So, odd that, where's Joseph at this point while his brothers are out shepherding the flock? He's at home, right? He's watching Oprah eating bonbons, I don't know. But the idea is, he's not having to do the same work. So, how does that feel when they're out busting their rump, taking, you know, the shepherds, the sheep around and trying to find, sleeping in the fields. And Joseph's at home, sleeping in a comfy bed, right, with a fireplace and what have you. And here comes brother rolling up, you know, coming to, all right, please report to me your, you know, earnings and losses. And, you know, so you can see just the situation that he's in, there's nothing favorable about it. It's just the deck is kind of stacked against him. So Joseph is sent by Jacob to go check on his brothers, okay? He rolls into Shechem and he basically says, hey, where are they? He had come to seek and says in verse 14, the welfare. He finds a man in verse 15. He says, hey, where are my brothers? He said, have you seen them? And he says in verse 17, they have moved on. They went to Dothan. So they're rolling basically north from Hebron up to Shechem and then onward. Okay, so they're in, the Shephelah, the green hill. So this is the place where you would pasture sheep. potentially to shear them or what have you, but they're in the right spot, and they're nomadic, right? So the shepherd's job every day was to lead the sheep into green pastures, okay? So that's the imagery, by the way, of Psalm 23, okay? So it's the shepherd's job to make sure that the sheep can eat, and there may be enough for an hour or two, but there's never enough for, like, weeks on end. No, you slept in the fields with your sheep. You would take them for periods of time, depending on where the food was, and then you would bring them back. So it's fascinating. Again, this is one of the pieces of the land that is really interesting. When you go to Israel, you're going to see sheep and shepherds in this area, right? You'll see them in the green areas, but you're also primarily going to see them in the desert. You think, why would I shepherd sheep in the desert? Well, there's more room. You're away from Israel's compact, but the Bedouins, like all these guys, they're in the Negev, right? That's where they grew up, was in Beersheba. They shepherded sheep. So what kind of green pastures are in, you know, that area? There aren't, right? I don't know about you guys, but I always think, or I thought before I went to Israel, of the Microsoft screensaver. I'm not a fan of Microsoft, but like you think of the green rolling hills, right? And they're lush and the sheep are frolicking about. That's not Israel, right? That's not the land. The land is rock, and it's kind of barren, and there are sprigs of green, and the shepherd leads you, and you eat then, and then you've eaten everything. Well, where's our next meal come from? I don't know. Where is the shepherd going to take me? So they are completely dependent for food and water and life on the shepherd, okay? And every day the shepherd has to lead them, and that's the beauty of Psalm 23. It's not, here's this lush field, go graze for like 2 months, and then call me when you need me again. It's like, no, you need me in an hour. So really cool picture, again, of that role. And there's a reason that God calls us sheep, because we're dumb, stinky, stupid, smelly animals a lot, and we need a shepherd to guide us and lead us, or we'll die. So, again, powerful imagery. So they're doing what shepherds are supposed to be doing. They're pasturing their flock. They're taking them to new places, sleeping out in the middle of nowhere, right, and just, you know, making it work, okay? So as he rolls up, verse 18, they see Joseph coming. This is their response. So this has gotten to a whole nother degree of, right, when they're conspiring now to put their brother to death based on this favoritism, we're moving quickly through the story, but you can just build in your head the animosity and the difficulty that this must have brought onto Joseph, where this is a logical response from the brothers, and enough of the brothers where no one steps up and says, no, that's stupid, and the majority don't feel that way. The majority feel that way. They want them gone, okay? Now, look who steps up. I'll keep reading to 19 and 20.
Here comes that dreamer, they said to each other. Come now. Let's kill him and throw him into one of the cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dream.
I mean, you can just see the mocking, right? I mean, that's stern. Now, to their credit, or to his credit, look who steps up in verse 21. So who steps up? Why is that significant? Reuben's the firstborn, right? So kudos, right? What was the last time we saw Reuben singled out? What was he doing? He was sleeping with his father's concubine, right? Trying to do a power play. So he's making an effort. So kudos to Reuben, okay? The problem is his voice is on mute with his brothers because he's kind of blown it with dad. He doesn't have the... They're going to listen to this, but he realizes that he can't... He doesn't have enough oomph in his relationship with his other 10 brothers, not including Joseph, to turn the tide of this conversation. There is a guy that does, but he doesn't have the chops yet either. But we're going to see that leadership role change within the family. Right now it's Reuben, okay? But he's made kind of a dumb decision. Why else is that significant? Are Reuben and Joseph full-blood brothers? No, right? Reuben is from Leah, and Joseph is from Rachel. So... it's significant. This isn't Dinah. Tamar's coming next chapter. And Simeon and Levi, full blood brothers, sticking up for full blood. This is a selfless move in a sense, but he's still just kind of, his suggestion's kind of, 22, this is what he says.
Back
Okay, so what's going on in Reuben's head? Exactly. I'll be the favored guy. Okay, so I'll win dad's favor. So interesting. So it is, in a sense, selfless. He's like, let's not kill him. But it seems like, based on what we're going to see in the text, his plan is, hey, he's going to pitch to his brothers. Let's not do that. We'll throw him in a pit. I'll come back and rescue him after everyone's left. I'll bring him back, and now I'll be the hero. So selfish, selfless, a little bit of both, right? But at least he's trying to make an effort. But I think he sees an opportunity, and he realizes that he needs just his father's, you know, he wants that back. So note the self, by the way, just kind of a dad message. When sons and daughters, I guess it applies to both, do not have the love and approval from their father, they will go to great lengths to get it, okay? And there's different responses that you get from both. Some have tendencies to be the A-plus student, shining star, example, firstborn like Reuben. That's their tendency, right? They will be the, sometimes, it just depends, but the goody-goody two-shoes, and I will do everything perfect. I'll be the best at sports. I'll be the best at whatever, so that my dad will say, I love you. I'm proud of you. You're good at these things, right? What's the other reaction that you see from kids that don't go that route to get daddy's attention? Rebel, right? If you don't love me, I will find someone that does. I will find my love in unhealthy relationships. I will find my love in whatever. But if I'm not going to get positive attention from you, then I will get attention from you, and it will be negative, okay? We're going to see this with one of David's kids. David will not give his son attention. And this kid says, great. He takes his next-door neighbor and sets his field on fire. He's like, are you listening to me now? Right? He begged his dad for attention, and he wouldn't give it to him. Just, I wanted love and acceptance. So just fascinating that that's Reuben's motivation right now. His dad has rejected him, and Reuben's caused that, right? He's made an oops, and we don't know what's happened there. But Jacob has kind of shunned him, if you will, and he's trying to win back the love of his father. So amazing how deep that motivation can be. So dad specifically, when you have kids, remember that. Okay, kids need to hear, I love you, I'm proud of you, you are good at fill in the blank. Every kid needs to hear that from their dad. Okay, so just note the self. Something, right? Joseph 17, Reuben is probably, I don't know, that's a great question. I would guess at least 10 years older. He's probably up there. So I'm trying to think mathematically. I don't know that we get in age. So, good question. I didn't know. Callie, you keep asking hard questions. I don't know the answer to. Stop talking. It's easy. That's good. So, yeah, I don't know. I will try to look it up and find it. How about that? I don't know. All right, so that's his plan. Okay, let's keep going. So 23 came about. Joseph reached his brother. They stripped him of his tunic, right? His very colored tunic that was on him, the thing that they despised. They took him and threw him in the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it, okay? By the way, where would you get big, deep, empty pits without water in them? What is that called? It's a well. It's a dry well, okay? You will see many of these in Israel, and as you go to them, you'll go, holy cow, he got stuck in one of those. There's various different wells. You have wells that are like we think of here, just huge, long, you know, holes dug into the earth that maybe some of these are hundreds of feet deep, probably not back that day, hundreds. And then you have cisterns, okay, which are water tanks that would hold runoff water. So when it would rain, they would find the lowest point in the given area of land, dig a deep hole, and all the water would drain in there, and they would save it for the rest of the year, okay? So there's two options as to which one it was, but you can see those in Israel, okay? But either way, frightening, and the idea is he's not getting out, okay? You can't climb yourself out of these, right? It's bad, okay? So he is in a pit. 25, pick up there. Jason, read if you will.
Then they sat down to eat.
No, just for a second, think about that. Where's Joseph? In a pit, and what are they doing? How's it going down there? I'm like, really? Like, they don't leave. They don't feel a sense of remorse. I mean, they're just, wow. Eat a meal. Keep going.
Looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal? shield of blood. Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him.
So what do you see? What's the new idea? Profit. Let's make some money, right? Here come, man, this is like cousin Ishmael, right? He's related to us somehow, right? So they're rolling down. They're coming back from the Gilead down into Egypt. Let's sell him. Let's make some money, right? We're already in trouble. And let's do that, okay? Who's speaking here?
Judah,
okay? And what do you notice the brother's response is to Judah's voice? They listen, okay? Are you seeing the change in... There's a leadership change. So this is the fourthborn, but he has, Reuben has the position of leadership within the family. Judah's the one that's actually followed, right? He doesn't have the stamp of approval, the title, but he is the guy, I forget the word that John Maxwell has, one of typical John Maxwell sayings if you listen to him. He doesn't have the title of leadership, but he is the perceived leader, okay? So, note the self. You don't need a title to lead. He is the guy that is followed at this point. Reuben has lost his voice because of his oops, and now Judah is the guy that's beginning to kind of rise to fame. Now, Judah's got some significant character issues that we're going to see next chapter, okay? But for what it's worth, he is kind of the leader, okay? So they're like, great, let's make money. 28, some of the Midianite traders passed by. They pulled him out of the pit, lifted Joseph up, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, which is dirty cheap, okay? Thus, they brought Joseph into Egypt, okay? So this is God's crazy behind-the-scenes plan, is to get this kid to Egypt, and again, we'll see the story. Now, 29, this is kind of an interesting text. Read that. Hold on real quick. So stay right there. So what do you imply from the text? When this conversation went down with Judah and the rest of his brothers, where's Reuben? He's gone, right? So he's off with the sheep or something else is happening or, you know, I don't know, maybe he's doing dishes, but he's not there when this transpires. So he's off and he comes back and realizes, oh, crud, my plan is bad. Now I'm going to get shamed in front of Dad. So this is really bad for Reuben. Tears his clothes. The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go? Who is he concerned with? You seen his motives come out, right? So I didn't just want to save my brother, which I guess would have been good, but it's really all about me, okay? So he realizes he's hosed. He made an effort, but man, he's done. Reuben is now on the bench, okay? They took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered the male goat, and dipped the tunic in blood, and they sent the varicolored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it. See whether it's your son's tunic or not." Okay, and of course, Jacob says, yep, it is. A wild beast devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. Okay, Jacob tore his clothes in verse 34, put on sackcloth and loins, and mourned for many days. And then read his response in verse 35. So how do all the rest of the brothers feel in the midst of this? Like he will not stop. Like he won't get out of his hole, right? You're like, look, the rest of us are still alive, right? We realize this is bad, but they're trying to pull their dad out of this funk and he won't get there. So you want to talk about exacerbating the situation. Like this favoritism has just made, it's even worse now. Even when he's dead, he's still the favorite kid and he's not even here, right? According to Dad. So it's awful, okay? It goes down to Sheol, by the way. You guys familiar with Sheol? Sheol is an Old Testament context. It is basically a holding tank for the dead, okay, prior to judgment. So you guys will see that throughout. It's not necessarily positive or negative. As it's not hell. It's not heaven. It's a resting place for all the dead until judgment, okay? So that's the idea, all right? But it's their imagery for death. And we will get that expounded upon into the New Testament with what God does ultimately with all of that. But that is kind of their description of what happens after death. You go down to Sheol. Okay, so make sense? All right, so meanwhile, the Midianites sold him. So the travelers get down to Egypt. They roll into town. They sell Joseph to make some money off him to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. Okay, so Joseph is now in town. He's been sold. He just happens to be sold to one of the most powerful men in all of Egypt, right? This is Pharaoh's bodyguard, Potiphar, and he is now going to be a steward in his house, right? He's a foreigner. He's an Israelite living in Egypt, and he's a slave, okay? And we're going to see his plight, all right? His story actually picks up in chapter 39. 38 is a parenthesis, and it's all about Judah and what's happened with him, okay? So kind of a weird chapter, but it's good. So let's read it, shall we? 38:1, somebody pick up there. Adullamite. So, Rachel, where is she from? Where would an Adullamite be from? The caves of Adullam. See? So now these words go, okay, so we're going to go visit Adullam. Adullam would have been like a neutral area in between the Shephela and the coastal plain, okay? So this is the spot where battles were fought. You didn't really necessarily live there. It's a fascinating place, okay? So Judah goes down there, finds a daughter of the Canaanites, so they had control of this area at the time, whose name was Shua, took her and went into her. She conceived and bore a son, okay? He's going to have three kids. Verse 3, the first one is Ur, the second one is Onan, and the fifth born is Shelah, okay? So this is like a boy named Sue, right? Okay, this is the country song. It came from right here. Judah has three kids, Onan, Shelah, okay? Just keep those in mind, okay? Judah took a wife for the firstborn, and her name was Tamar, okay? So the firstborn son has a wife. Her name is Tamar. She is important as well. But Judah's firstborn, did evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Well, dude, there's your life. Like, that's your life story right there. You were bad. God killed you. Moving on, verse 8. Right? So we don't see that a lot in Scripture. This guy must have been wicked bad, okay? So God kills him. So now we've got Tamar, right, who's left, who used to have a husband named okay? Apparently she is childless. So verse 8, see if this rings a bell. Verse 8, read that. Now, you remember that from yesterday? Hey, your brother died. They got no kids. Do your duty. Lay with her and make sure that she has male offspring. So, Tony, do your job. That's the idea, all right? Verse 9, Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So it came about when he went into his brother's wife that he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. So he will not fulfill his duty, okay? So he literally, not to be graphic, but has sex with her, won't finish because he knows if that wife does not have kids, where does the land go? Me! So very, very selfish move on his part. If she has no male kids, it begins when she dies, her inheritance goes to, or the inheritance of the older brother goes to who? Secondborn, me. You see his motivation? Okay, so that's the motivation. By the way, there's been some really bad preaching on this verse. If you guys have ever been a part of a junior high ministry, we won't get into it now, but this is the context, okay? So if you hear other angles of what this is and what the result of him not fulfilling his duty does, okay? Watch what God does as a result of him not fulfilling his kinsman redeemer duty. Verse 10. Wow. So you've got son one dead because he did wicked evil. We don't know why, okay? Son two won't fulfill his duty as a kinsman redeemer, wastes his seed on the ground. God says, you're dead. So now we've got one son left, right? Shelah. We got a boy named Sue that's left, okay? And one wife that's still living, okay? So God is pretty ticked at Judah and his family right now. And you're going to see that Judah's not the most righteous guy. And it's no wonder that his kids are, you know, a little jacked, okay? So anyway, context for you guys for later. When you hear this and somebody preaches stupid on this, this is why God took his life, okay? The job was to be a kinsman redeemer. He did not fulfill his duty, and God took his life. So, harsh penalty, but regardless, okay? So Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up, okay? So, hey, whoops, I forgot to give you or tried to. That didn't work out so well. Shelah will ultimately be your new husband, so now we're going to have Shelah and Tamar married, which is weird. We don't know who's the boy and who's the girl, but there you go. All right? So he says, wait. He says, I'm afraid that he too might die like his brother. So let's get him like through puberty first, and then I will marry him with you. Okay? So that's the idea. So she's like, okay, I get to be a widow until this kid grows up, and then that's going to be my husband. We're going to have kids. Okay? So that's Judah's plan. All right? So this kid's got to grow up first. Verse 12, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And at the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to the sheep shears at Timnah, and he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. Okay, so they're in this time of mourning. They go up to Timnah. Anybody remember someone important from Scripture that is from Timnah? Those of you that have been to Israel know. The story of Samson. Samson finds a hottie in Timnah, a Canaanite woman, and decides he wants to marry her and tells mom and dad, go get her for me, okay? So we are in an area of pagans, okay, of Canaanite non-believers. That is where Judah goes during this time of mourning. It was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going to Timnah to shear his sheep, okay? She removed her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enanim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up and had not been given to her as, or he had been not given to her as a wife, okay? So she realizes, Judah lied to me. He's not going to give his youngest son, Shelah, to me as a husband, so I'm going to fix this situation myself. This gal is shrewd, but she's brilliant, okay? It's awful, but this is what happens. So she takes off her widow's clothing, and it says she puts on a veil and wraps herself. Verse 14, what is she doing?
Is she dressing herself
as a prostitute? She's feigning to be a prostitute, okay? So here comes Judah. What does she know about Judah, by the way? He has a hankering for prostitutes, okay? So that's the idea. So she knows this. She dresses herself as a prostitute. Judah saw her. He thought she was a harlot, verse 15, for she had covered her face. She turned aside, or he turned aside and said, here now, let me come into you. This is his, yeah, okay, so odd. I guess that's how they introduced themselves back then. So, hi. Sorry, it's funny. I'm trying not to make light of it. It's weird for us, right? So she says, this is brilliant. What will you give me that you may come into me? So what is your payment going to be? Verse 12, this is what he says. Read that. 17. When I say 12, you mean 17. Add 5. Yeah, there you go. Or just add 5.
He answered, I will send you a goat from the flock. And she said, if you give me a pledge...
Okay, so she's going to get a goat, so great deal. But how do I know you're going to send this to me? Because once you leave, right, I need a down payment. What's your down payment going to be, 18? Keep going, Jacob.
He said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand.
Okay, so what is she asking for? What is a signet and a cord? Okay, why is that significant? Absolutely. So she is asking for his driver's license, a major credit card, and his social security number. That's basically what she's saying. I need evidence that identifies you is only you. So if I have these, everybody knows who I'm dealing with. Okay, so brilliant. And he's like, that's fine, right? Oh, I forgot my money, right? You go to the store. Here's my ID. Thank you for the groceries. I'll come back with a check because I really need my ID, or I really need whatever, right? You guys have probably been in a pinch like that before, and a really nice store owner's been like, oh, yeah, or maybe not. I forget my wallet all the time. So I've done that before, more than once. I'll be back. They know I want my driver's license or whatever, so you leave something of value, and they know you're going to pay them, okay? So that's the idea. Here's my signet ring that you would stamp like a king, would put that in a wax stamp and seal a letter, and you would know that letter was closed in wax with the king's ring on it, you would realize that is from King whomever, and it hasn't been touched. It has his impression on it, okay? So that's the idea, all right? So he says, great, deal. So verse 18, he gave to her, he went into her, and she conceived by him. So she just had sex with her father-in-law, and now she is with child, okay? So ick, but here we go. 19, she arose, departed, removed her veil, put on her widow's garments. Judah sent a young goat by his friend the Adullamites, received the pledge from the woman's hand, but he couldn't find her. She was like, huh, I brought the goat, went to get all my stuff back, and she's not there. They ask around saying, hey, where's the prostitute that normally hangs out here? Okay, verse 21, they say, there's been no prostitute at the temple. We don't know what you're talking about. So he returns to Judah and says, man, I couldn't find her. I asked the people. They had no idea what I was talking about. So Judah says in verse 23, let her keep them, otherwise we will become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her. So he's like, oh, great. Well, I'll just go to the DMV and get another one, I guess. So I'm not sure what his answer is to that. But he realizes, oh, man, this is probably going to come back to haunt me. It's not ideal. I mean, again, she's not remarriable, right? So now she's going to have to live in her home underneath her dad and be cared for. So it's not ideal for sure. So better would be husband, inheritance, that sort of thing. So this would have been a, what's the word I'm looking for? Anyway, it would have been very shameful to her to have gone through that, and for Judah not to keep his word, not once now, but twice, okay? So she's taking matters into her own hands, which there's a part of that I go, good for you, you know? So I don't like your means, but you know what? You're brilliant, okay? Now, you can imagine how the story ends up, right? 3 months later, Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is with child by harlotry. So he finds out, daughter-in-law's been sleeping around, she's been a prostitute. And Judah's response, read that at the end of verse 24. Here's what Judah says should happen. Jane, read that.
Judah says, bring her out and have her burned to death.
Like, whoa, easy, right? Is that a bit of an overreaction? I would say so, right? Harlotry in, you know, Israel was not liked. They're certainly an appropriate consequence, according to the Old Testament, could have been death. But, wow, set her on fire? Like, dude, do you have any compassion? And what's the, not the, yeah, it's like, dude, then set yourself on fire, right? I mean, buddy, you're guilty of the exact same thing. Now, to Judah's credit, we're going to see his character come out in the midst of calamity, in the midst of his own stupidity. So bring her out, okay? And watch what happens. Jane, keep going in 25. Whoops. Okay, well, let's see him. So what does she have in her hand? I got a signet ring. I've got your cord. I've got your driver's license, Social Security. There's no getting around it. Like, the guy that impregnated, these are his, right? And it's not, I wonder who that is, right? So she said, please examine in verse 25 and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. Judah recognized them. Like, you can just hear the gigantic gulp in his throat at that point. I'm like, oh, man, I just got played. She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son, Shelah. So you get the impression that he repents and realizes, man, I blew it. He's going to have to walk through the story probably, but we don't see. Repent of that and realizes the reason that she did that was why? It's my fault. I should have given her the boy named Sue, and I didn't, and as a result, she took matters in her own hand. So kudos to him. He takes responsibility for her actions. So good for him, okay? We're going to see Judah now. This is the pit for him. He just bottomed out, right? And now he's coming back up. So he's repented, and we're going to see his life's trajectory in another 20-plus years and what's happened to this guy in the meantime, okay? So lest we think Reuben slept with a concubine, Simeon and Levi, they ousted themselves because they killed everybody in Shechem, and Judah is now the shining bright example of godliness in the family. He's not, okay? So for whatever reason, God chose to bless this kid. He's got some natural leadership talent, apparently. He is the voice that is listened to by his brothers, but he is not some moral shining star, right? His brother Joseph certainly would have fit that category a lot better, okay? So there you go. 27, it came about in time that she was giving birth. Behold, that there were twins in her womb. Okay, so now we still got Tamar, who's been impregnated by father-in-law, Judah, right? And watch this. Again, the whole theme of God's sovereign election, watch what happens. 28, read that.
And when she was in labor, one put out a hand. The midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first.
All right, so the first kid, hands out of the womb. Midwife ties the string around the hand, and then the kid pulls his hand back in the womb, okay? Drew his elbow back, verse 29, that behold, his brother then came out. So it was like a switcheroo. Now, man, I know a little bit about giving birth, but that's crazy. So I don't know how that happened. But he was like on his way out, and he's like, you turn. And then brother's like, move over, right? So the firstborn that actually comes out first, that should have been the secondborn, was named Perez. Afterward, verse 30, his brother with a string on his hand comes out, and he is named Zerah. Okay, so Perez, the secondborn, now firstborn, is in the line of Christ. He is the one that's going to be the promised seed. So he shows up in Matthew chapter 1, and he also shows up in Ruth. He is in the lineage of Christ. So did God choose, you know, the picture of sovereign election, the secondborn, technically, or not technically, but would have been, supposed to be, and comes out first, and that's the chosen kid. Okay, so again, bizarre. All right? So there you go, Judah and Tamar. The word no doesn't mean no there. It means what it meant in Sodom and Gomorrah. He did not know her again. That's the word yada. He did not sleep with her again. Yeah. No, he should not sleep with her. That's his daughter-in-law. So Shua, we don't see the rest of that story. The assumption would be that they ended up together. So he realized that was my fault, and they probably had a nice marriage ceremony after that. So, but father-in-law did not sleep with his daughter-in-law anymore, which is good. That's recommended. That is good course of action, okay? So there's a whole chapter on his oops, right? Okay, so 39, we're back in Egypt, okay? So now the drama has shifted, right? So back in Egypt with Joseph, and let's watch his plight. 39:1. Okay, keep reading verse 2.
The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of the Egyptian master.
Now, talk to me about verse 2. How's Joseph feeling about right now? Do you feel like God is with you in the midst of that? I just got thrown in a pit. My brothers wanted to kill me. One brother happened to step up and say, let's not kill him. Let's make some money. Let's sell him. He's now in a foreign land, hundreds of miles away, a slave. He used to be what? He's the boss, and now he's a slave in some foreign dude's house. Have no idea how he's being treated yet. Now we're going to see his character exemplified. Is that a time in his life where he would say, yeah, God is with me? This guy's got perspective, and we'll see it from... This is just kind of noted from Moses, but we're going to see it in his own words, that he has the sense of, just because my life isn't on a mountaintop and I happen to be in a valley, doesn't change the fact that God is with me. So this kid has amazing perspective and maturity for a kid that's in difficulty, right? It's amazing how we often get that backwards, right? Life's horrible, it's hard, God has abandoned me. Where do we get that theology? That's nowhere in Scripture. You're going through difficulty, and that's when God is there in the most intimate of times, right? But we expect our circumstances to dictate how God loves us, right? We have that performance mentality. If God's with me, then what? I should be blessed. I should have this. It should show up in my life, right? One of the guys who did that in Scripture, that if we lived out that theology, was Samson. Samson was blessed. He had everything going for him, and God was horrified at his life and his lifestyle. And here's Joseph at the bottom rung, and it's like he's going to continue to find new bottom, right? He didn't know hadn't hit bottom yet. He thought he had. It's going to get worse, okay? And yet God is with him. So fascinating to me that this kid has the perspective in the midst of that to go, God has not abandoned me, right? A lot of maturity, okay? So amazing. So Joseph, again, you look at him and go, man, I'm pretty sure I would not have had that attitude. Like, and this is early in the game, right? So, all right, keep going. Verse 2, sorry.
Three.
Or wherever you left off.
His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hand.
My goodness, tell me about that. What's his attitude publicly? God is blessing me. And God's with me, and I'm going to act like it, right? I'm not going to bury my head in the pillow and cry and act like my life's miserable like that. Okay, this is the new reality. Let's move on. What do the non-Christians around him see? Dude, God's, something's different with this kid. We don't know your God. We don't worship your God. Kind of really don't even like your God. However, we like what your God brings, which is blessing. So, holy cow. So, promotion, we're going to give you a ton, right? His master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. Now, if you're Potiphar, who would you normally thank for the blessings in your life? Pharaoh, who thought he was a god, or the other gods that they worship, Ra, the sun god, or they've got a gazillion that we'll get into in the book of Exodus. They worship a ton of other gods. What does this guy realize? It's not just Joseph, it's what? It's Joseph's God, and it's a different God. So what do you infer from that? How does this guy find out that your blessing happens to be from a God that I don't know? He's sharing. He's talking about his faith. He's talking about the God that he worships and believes in. And my life sucks right now, but I still follow this God, right? God's amazing, right? I like Joseph. He's a very humbling character. I'm thankful that the whole Bible isn't full of Josephs because I'd be very depressed. But he is phenomenal in his character, and we don't see him. That's it. I mean, the only potential dark spot in his whole life is when he was 17 and shared dreams and probably maybe could have handled that differently. I don't know. Maybe he did exactly what God wanted him to do. From here forward, the guy's insane. So, verse 4, what's the result?
So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had.
Okay, so keep going.
From the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and field.
Now, if you're Potiphar, if you put Joseph in charge, what in the sense does that mean? Who else would Potiphar have had in his home? Kids? What else? Would he have other slaves? Would he have other people working for him that were probably Egyptian? So you just put an Israelite in charge of all the Egyptians? I mean, do you see the significance of that? Like, this is a foreigner, and I just made you in charge of my whole home. And I superseded you over my own kinsmen, people that speak my language, people that I know, that I'm familiar with. He's like, no, you're the guy. I see the blessing that God is putting in your life. So this is a big deal, right? So you again see how God is exalting this kid. Verse 6, he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Now, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, okay? He literally has the keys to Potiphar's house. And Potiphar says, great, anything you want, Joseph, you're in charge. You steward the home. You see how even in the midst of this, how do you think Joseph learned how to lead, how to administrate, how to organize a home? God put him in a situation where he did it for a season at a much smaller level so that when God asked him to do that for a nation and ultimately the world, he had the skills to do it. Now, how did he have to get him there? It's difficult, right? I mean, this is a horrible situation as you take a step back and look at it. But this was God's plan for him. And he had a season in his life where he was unknown. He was felt deserted. It felt difficult. And yet God is, again, no wasted motion. God had a purpose for all of this in his life. And one day, God's going to simply snap his fingers. The direction of the wind is going to change. And all of a sudden, what felt like difficulty and abandonment to maybe to us, all of a sudden is a blessing. And Joseph goes, got it, right? And he had the perspective the whole time to realize what God was doing. But sometimes we get stuck in these moments of life and we don't take advantage of where God has us because we're so concerned about where we want to be or what God should have done that we miss the fact that, no, this is where God has you now and where he wants you for a purpose, okay? So Joseph is learning how to lead, right? And he's done a bit at home, but he's even doing more here, okay? So don't overlook the significance of his position, why he would have been there, how he got there. And then what do we see at the end of verse 6? What's mentioned of him? He's a good-looking dude, right? He's a young, strapping man, right? Now, note the self. Sometimes in life, our greatest strengths can end up being our weaknesses, and that's what bites us in the butt. We're going to see the fact that, man, Joseph would have been a lot better off had he just been ugly, right? But he's not. So unfortunately, Potiphar's wife says, man, that guy, interested in him. So verse 7, it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, lie with me, right? That is a come on, right? That, and she is not mixing words. Three words, and she says, I want to sleep with you, okay? So Joseph's in a rough spot, right? So master's wife has now turned her attention to him. He's just trying to be a faithful steward. And here we go. Verse 8, keep it going. Okay, give me some observations on Joseph's response there. What do you like? Yeah, right? Immediately exalts. I mean, he's able to see the bigger picture. Like, my master is taking great care of me. How dare I take advantage of that? What else?
He kind of, he knows his boundaries and he's not necessarily looking for more. He knows what the Lord has given him.
That's a great perspective, right? He's not greedy, okay? Yeah, talk to me about that, Casey.
Well, at the point, the commandments haven't been given.
Right.
He knows in God's eye this is a sin.
Right. Do you see what he does there? That's a great observation. It's not a sin against his master. It's a sin against God. God who has abandoned me, who's left me for dead. I mean, do you see what Joseph could have done? The heck with that? Fine. God's not even here. I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to live like the Egyptians. So great. So clearly following God has not gotten me anywhere. Right? I'm here now, and this stinks. So he doesn't do that, right? Just, again, a ton of respect for him. So you see his understanding of sin and his desire to honor God, even in the midst of a, you know, no one's around. So problem is verse 10, it came about as she spoke to Joseph day after day. I mean, what a rough spot to be in, right? He's the steward of the house. He can't leave. He's a slave. So he's stuck there. He's trying to do a good job, but he has to interact with her constantly, constantly, day after day after day, right? So, and I'm just going to go on a limb here. If you're Potiphar and you're the master of Pharaoh's, like, second in command, what would you guess his wife looked like? I'm just, you know, this probably is not a, oh, God, no, I don't want any part of that, right? Joseph probably... he probably had a very attractive wife who on many levels would have been physically appealing to him, right? And he's a 17, 18, 19, 20, I don't know how old he is exactly at this point, but he's a male, right? So that's the idea. So tough spot, okay? It came about as she spoke to Joseph day after day that he did not listen to her to lie beside her or to be with her. What else do you notice he doesn't do? Yeah, he's trying to avoid her. He's not going down that road at all, okay? So chops, kudos to him. Came about one day that he went into the house to do his work, right? Just doing what God's called him to do and what Potiphar's asked of him. And none of the men of the household were inside. Like, uh-oh, that's a bad situation. She caught him by his garment saying, lie with me. Like, she's up in the ante and it's a little bit more forceful now. And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. Like, what a response. Like, that's... good for him, right? He leaves immediately, okay? She saw that he had left his garment in her hand and he had fled outside. She's now angry because she's been turned down. You get the impression that this isn't a gal that gets turned down often, right? So she's so angry that she now is going to frame him, okay? See, verse 14, he has brought in a Hebrew to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me and I screamed. He was going to rape me and I... threw him off me, tore his garment, screamed, and he ran out of the house, and I have his garment in my hand to prove it. Like, Joseph is like, man, I can't win, right? I've done everything right, and here I am, okay? It came about when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, that he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside the house. Verse 17, master finds out, so Potiphar gets home. Wife says, the Hebrew slave who you brought to us came in to make sport of us. It happened, so she tells the story to him. And this is his response in verse 19. Here's what Potiphar does. Okay, stop right there for a second. So what happens to Joseph? He gets thrown in jail. Now, he's a foreigner. He just, we think, tried to make an advance on Potiphar's wife. What would you suppose Potiphar would have the right to do?
Kill him.
Kill him, right? What's he do with him? This is like Martha Stewart jail, right? You're going to find out. It's not luxury, so don't get the wrong picture in your head. He's in jail. But he's with the cupbearer. And the baker, guys that had wronged Pharaoh in a moment and got booted for whatever reason, this is not maximum security. You know, you're getting whipped every day where there's murders and whatever. These are, you get the impression that his life could have been a lot worse. Now, it's not good, but it could have been worse. He's still in a jail, and he's still isolated, and he's been put in difficulty. Okay, so that's the idea. However, what do we see in verse 21? Immediately on the heels of difficulty, what do we see? The Lord was with Joseph, right? And it continues to be repeated. In the midst of Joseph's difficulty, God is there, okay? Extends kindness to him, gave him favor inside of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail so that whatever was done, he was responsible for it. Dude, like a verse later, the guy gets thrown in the jail, and now he's in charge of the jail. Like, are you kidding me? The gifting of this guy is so apparent that everybody can see it. I mean, it's amazing to me, right? Verse 23, the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made him to prosper. So, fascinating that even in that environment, this guy chose to have a great attitude, work for God, and as a result, everyone around him got to see it, okay? Now, 40, we're going to see Joseph's dreams and this background that he has now. We're going to see why God gave him this gifting in particular. Let's pick up in 40, verse 1.
Sometime after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker committed an offense against the Lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them, and he attended them. They continued for some time in custody.
All right, so Joseph takes care of these guys. Okay, so again, so smaller offenses, these guys get thrown in jail, okay? These guys both happen to have a dream. Joseph, after he finds out about this in verse 6, says, "Why do your faces look so dejected?" He says to them in verse 8, "We've had a dream, and there's no one to interpret it." And Joseph said, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please." So these guys have had dreams. They've totally haunted them. They don't know what they mean, and they say, "That's why we're depressed." And what's Joseph's answer? Notice the subtlety of what he says. End of verse 8. "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please." Yep. What would his natural inclination have been? Who does he give credit to here? God. Not me. I know dreams. I interpret dreams. God reveals dreams to me. He says, no, interpretations belong to God. Tell them to me. Do you see the subtle difference? He points to God, and he's going to do it again in a more important moment. Yeah, it's just Elohim or the generic name for God. I think we're going to see...
Well, at this point, God has not revealed himself as Yahweh to Jacob's family. This is Moses writing, so when he says it's Moses writing the Lord, not Moses.
Yeah, but we've seen God's name used early on in Genesis 2, as early as the idea of Yahweh. So, yeah, but you're also seeing... in his life, there's a clear distinction between which God he's following. So I think, I'm assuming there would have been a knowledge that he's not saying, Ra, the sun god, is going to interpret this for you, based on his life. So, and he's going to do it again, and he uses the same word. It's just God, not Yahweh. So, For what it's worth, that's interesting. So he says, reveal it to me, okay? And then here's the cupbearer's dream, okay? Verse 9, he says, in my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me. The vine had three branches. It was budding. Blossoms came out of it, and clusters produced grapes. Now Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup in Pharaoh's hand, okay? So this guy used to be a cupbearer, right? He had Nehemiah's job. He was a cupbearer to the king. The idea was, you drank the wine, you tasted the steak, okay, I didn't die, you get to eat. He's a trusted guy, and that was his job. So he now sees Pharaoh's cup back in his hand, and he's serving and attending to Pharaoh. And he says, what does that mean? And Joseph says, well, here's what it means. Verse 12, pick up there. So what's the promise? You're getting your job back, right? It's a great dream. Awesome. Okay. And what does he ask in verse 14?
Only remember me when it is well with you. And please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh and so get me out of this house.
Right. So he's obviously not enjoying his stay. So he says, hey, you're going to get out. When you're at that position again, a very trusted position with Pharaoh, mention me, remember me, and tell Pharaoh about me, okay? Verse 15, he tells his story of being kidnapped, and he's a Hebrew, thrown in this dungeon, you know, I'm innocent, just like every other prisoner in there would have said, right? But Joseph actually is. So now the chief baker sees that the cupbearer's dream interpretation went well, and he says, hey, Joe, I had a dream, here's my dream, okay? Verse 16, in my dream, behold, there were three baskets of white bread on my head. In the top basket, there were some of all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh, and the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. What does that mean? And Joseph says, well, here's what it means. Verse 18, this is interpretation. The baskets are 3 days. Within three more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh off of you. Sorry, buddy. Your dream kind of sucks. So, yeah, it's not good, right? So he was hoping for better news. And I appreciate, I think in the midst of this, what would Joseph's tendency would have, what do you think his tendency or his, what would he want to do in that situation?
Soften it.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, it's the bread is, yeah, right? Enjoy the day, right? Eat good, you know. We're going to get you a steak today. So, he just... Both barrels, man, here it is, right? And he just tells them. So, sorry, buddy. And sure enough, verse 21, God restores the chief cupbearer to his office, or Pharaoh does, and he put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker just as Joseph had interpreted them. So exactly what Joseph said is going to happen happens. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Jerk face. So he gets his job back, and, right? So here is Joseph being completely faithful, honoring God with what he's doing. He makes one request of this guy. He saves his life, in a sense, or at least tells him what God's going to do or what Pharaoh's going to do, and nothing, okay? So fast forward, verse chapter 41, verse 1. Read that.
After 2 whole years, Pharaoh
knew
that he was standing by the Nile.
Okay, 2 full years. Okay, so there's 2 more years that he spent in prison. Now, we don't have the exact timeline, but look at verse 46. How old is Joseph when he gets out of prison?
30.
Okay. So he goes to Egypt when he's 17. He's been in jail for some amount of time. It looks like he spent potentially up to 13 years in slavery, right? Maybe at the most 13. He was in Potiphar's house for some season. We don't know how long, but he spends at least 2 years in jail, potentially upwards of 13 years, depending on kind of the timeline, okay? So either way, not good. 2 years is plenty of time. If it was 13, gosh, that's horrific, okay? So now who's having a dream? Verse 1, Pharaoh's having a dream, okay? What's his dream? Verse 2.
Fed in the reed grass, Behold, seven other cows only in pen came up out of the Nile after them, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. And the ugly thin cows ate up the seven attractive plum cows. And Pharaoh awoke.
Okay, so this is his first dream, okay? He has another dream, which is the same thing. In verse 5, 7 ears of corn on a stalk, plump and good. Then 7 ears thin and scorched by the east wind sprouted up after them. So he has two different dreams. He awakes after both and is wrecked by these. Okay, his spirit, verse 8, is troubled. He calls for everybody that he knows to. In verse 8, the magicians, all the wise men, and all the guys look at him dumbfounded and have no idea what these mean. Okay. End of verse 8, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Then, verse 9.
Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, I remember my offenses today when Pharaoh was angry with his servant and put me in the chief baker's custody in the house of the captain of the guard. We dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with his own interpretation. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. When he told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream. And as he interpreted to us, so it came about. I was restored to my office, and the baker was hanged.
So finally this guy goes, oh yeah, there was this guy in jail with me. I had a dream. Baker had a dream. You hung him, and I got my job back, and he told us all of our dreams, right? Watch what Pharaoh does as a result of this knowledge. Verse 14.
Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh.
Now think about this. One verse. What happens in Joseph's life? I mean, in a second, how fast can your life change? He's in a dungeon. Everyone that has a chance to exalt him, which was, this is the only guy, has forgotten him. It's 2 years later, he's done. And all of a sudden, God just changes the direction of the wind. And now he's got favor. He went from unshowered, big old shaggy beard and stinky to go take a shower, shave, and in 15 minutes you were standing before Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the known world at the time, who, by the way, thinks he's God. Okay? Amazing. God has been orchestrating this all behind the scenes, and Joseph has had the courage not to lose heart in the midst of this. Okay? So, he calls for Joseph. Verse 15, Pharaoh says to Joseph, I have had a dream, but no one can interpret it. And I want you to listen to the significance of these words. I have heard said about you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph's response, verse 16, Layla, read that.
Joseph answered to Pharaoh, it is not in me. God will give, God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer.
It is not within me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Like, that took some courage, right? I do not have this ability. God has this ability, and you get the idea that this is a different God than Pharaoh's use. I mean, that had to be a pretty intimidating place, right? Especially knowing what Pharaoh thought of himself. He was worshipped in Egypt as a god, okay? But God will give you an answer, okay? So, 17, he gets the dream recounted to him. Hey, there were these cows, big skinny cow, or the little skinny cows ate the big fat plump cows. There were seven of them. And then these wheat stalks, and he walks them through all of these dreams, okay? And he says at the end of verse 24, look, I've talked to everyone I know, the magicians, everyone else. Nobody can figure this out. I'm totally stumped. And 25 now, Joseph's going to speak up.
And Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one. The seven lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty ears blighted by the east winds are also 7 years of famine.
Okay, so you got seven good years coming, and then you got seven horrendous years coming, okay? So that's the idea. He says, your dreams are the same, and that's the plight of Egypt, okay? Verse 30, after them 7 years, a famine will come. All the abundance will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will ravage the land. This isn't a little bit bad. It's a whole lot of bad. But the good news is you got 7 years to get ready for this. Okay? Now, as for repeating the dream twice, he says, it means that the matter is determined by God, and God will quickly bring it about. So this is going to happen. And he doesn't waver. He says, this is what it means. This is what's going to happen. Okay? Now, 33, this is brilliant. Read that.
Now, therefore, Pharaoh selected discerning and wise men and sent him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take the one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store it grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through the famine.
Okay, so what does Joseph propose? What's he saying? Yeah, store of food, right? You need to save food, okay? What does he say in verse 33? You need to find a man with these qualities. You have a problem. And then what does Joseph propose? A solution. You need to find a guy who understands the problem and can communicate a solution. Here's your solution. What is Joseph saying? Put me in charge. Very respectfully, right? He doesn't demand it. He just says, you need someone with this skill set because you have this problem. Here's the solution to your problem. Pharaoh, you're a very wise man. And you see what he does? I mean, it's brilliant, right? By the way, where did God tell him to do that? He didn't. He saw a situation. He saw an opportunity to say, that is my gifting. That is what I'm good at. That is what God has wired me to do. Here is your problem. Here's your solution. Now find a really smart guy. You know, it's brilliant. And I tell you what, I like Pharaoh. Watch what he does. This had to be hard, right? The proposal, verse 37, seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. They all went, yeah, okay, no one else can interpret the dream. That sounds logical. Your solution, Joseph, sounds like it's like, duh, that's exactly what we should do. So Pharaoh says to Joseph, 38, read that. Keep going.
Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater
than you. Wow. You talk about exalted. He is now vice president of the world, right? That's insane. Now, what do you notice about Pharaoh? Does Pharaoh have the answer to this problem on his own? No. So he realizes without Joseph, I'm hosed, okay? It takes a very secure leader to find gifting in another leader that exceeds their own gifting in a certain area to say, you're the guy that we need to follow in this area. He's still in charge. He's still the guy that they're going to call God and bow down to, but he's not intimidated by other really gifted people around him. That's a rare quality in leadership, right? I don't like a lot of other things about Pharaoh, but the fact that he has enough security in his own leadership to say, that guy's got the answer and we're going to follow him, remember that as you guys are in leadership positions. To exalt other people that are more gifted in you than in other areas is very appropriate. Pharaoh had his own gifts, right? But they weren't these, okay? Surround yourself with people that are good at what you are not good at because they're better at it and they enjoy it, and you're going to find far more success in that. And in the midst of that, you've got to know the one or two things that you're really good at, okay? My list of things that I am good at is very short. I know what they are, and I do them. And the things that I stink at, I give to other people that are better than me, and hopefully I have enough security in the way God's gifted me to realize I'm not good at that. I need to hand that off, and that person's going to do a better job than me and enjoy it. So figure out what that is. It's so important that you know yourself, right? This is what I'm good at. This is what I'm not good at. And I'm okay with that. I can't change it. I can get better at what I'm good at, but man, if I stink at this, I can probably move to from a 2 to maybe a 4. But there's people that were born at an 8, and they can get better, and then they're going to be a 9.5. So why would I bother? So it's a fallacy to think that you can take all of your weaknesses and turn them into strengths. That doesn't happen. God has gifted you in certain areas. Spend your time developing your strengths and not disregard, but manage around your weaknesses. Bring in other people. Now, that doesn't mean that you just can't do stuff or you get to not do whatever because you're not gifted in those areas. But this is brilliant. I'll bring in gifted people, Pharaoh says, to handle things that I can't handle, and I'll do what I'm good at. Okay, so phenomenal leadership lesson from a non-Christian, right? There you go. So, he's in charge of everything. Pharaoh took off his signet ring, remember that, from his hand, put it on Joseph's hand, and says, "You're the guy." Clothed him in his garments of fine linen, put the gold necklace around his neck. He had him ride in his second chariot. They proclaimed before him, "Bow the knee," and he set all the land of Egypt over them. So not only does he identify him privately within this meeting, what else does he do? He parades Joseph in front of the entire nation and says, "All y'all, bow down to him. He's in charge. What he says for the next 14 years is like it's coming from my mouth." So, beautiful. He exalts someone else in the midst. Now, he had to write second to Pharaoh, which is, I guess, appropriate. Okay? 44, keep rolling there. Yeah, whatever that is. Gives him an Egyptian name, okay? And he gave him 2 Egyptian wives, okay? Asenath and the daughter of Potiphar, the priest of On. I'm sorry, 1 wife. And Joseph went forth over the land of Egypt, okay? So he has now got an Egyptian name, and he's got an Egyptian wife, okay? Now, for many, that can be seen problematic, but Joseph's going to hold his own, and he's going to love God in the midst of this, okay? So we're going to see that that's going to be a blessing, and it's going to be important for the rest of the story as he is going to look and act and speak and for all matters be 100% Egyptian, okay? And again, feature-wise, these are all folks from the Middle East, right? So they've got dark skin, dark hair, dark eyes. An Egyptian, an Israelite would not be that hard to distinguish. I mean, it would be difficult to distinguish because their features were predominantly very, very similar, right? So this isn't some like blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid from Sweden coming into Egypt. You're like, no. So later on in the story, when he feigns, "I'm an Egyptian," nobody would know the difference, right? So he looks and acts Egyptian in every way, okay? Let's stop there for today, okay? I've got a meeting at 8 that I need to get to across town. So we will pick up on the rest of the story next week, all right? You guys have a great weekend. Be safe. Enjoy yourself. We'll see you on Thursday.